Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name is Tanner. I'll be one of your hosts today. Bring in Taylor in just a minute. Before we do that, we have some new patrons to thank. So I want to say thank you to Jacob and Xander for joining us over on Patreon. We hope you enjoy the back catalog of bonus episodes you've got access to now. And we hope you're looking forward to the new stuff we're going to get out in season three. Looking forward to expanding on some of the type of content we put up on Patreon. Yeah, we're just looking forward to bringing some new stuff to the table. We do also have a Ko-fi account set up. If you want to throw us a few bucks for a one-time donation, you can do that too. We'll link to that in the show notes. So with all of the business stuff out of the way, let's bring in Taylor. Taylor, how's it going?
Pretty good. It's a little bit of a surprise snowstorm here in Ohio today. We were only supposed to get like an inch or a dusting, and I think we probably have at least 5 or 6 inches, which is, you know, Ohio handles snow pretty well, but that's enough to shut it down for the day. So kind of be a cozy day of watching football and doing a little podcasting. There's worse ways to spend time.
Yeah, we had a little bit the other day. We were supposed to get quite a bit. We ended up not getting quite that much, but enough that we ended up doing work from home on Thursday, since
nice.
I'm one of those lucky people who has a boss who actually like looks out for us and is like, hey, this looks like it's going to be the roads are going to be rough. Everybody work from home.
Yeah, that's nice.
Of course, I'm a teacher, but I only have one student right now. So easy enough to set up stuff through Teams and do things that way.
Sure.
Not exactly a break, but it was a little change up in the week.
Nice.
What else have you been up to besides being snowed upon?
Well, I'm fully NBA pilled now. Didn't see that coming. NBA is something I've kind of passively been into. I've always been more of a college basketball person, but I don't know. I've really gotten bitten by the bug. I think Ohio legalizing sports gambling has helped, obviously, because you kind of have that aspect, and it's just such a great sport for like individual statistics. Mm-hmm. So that's fun. It's just a fun sport to watch, and it's fun to watch like the NBA be so community involved and also like know how to promote their players. Mm-hmm. Like they basically do everything the exact opposite of baseball. Like they make the game accessible, they make their stars accessible, they promote their stars. You don't have the Shohei Ohtani conundrum that exists in baseball, which is like this generational talent that no one gets to see play.
Right. So it's insane how bad the Angels are having had, you know, Mike Trout and Ohtani. But I think also with the NBA, like you said about, you know, individual talent, it is much easier to get excited for a team. You know, a new season, they get a good draft pick, they get a good player. Like you look at Zion Williamson in New Orleans, and just the way that that makes people excited to watch a team that, you know, they maybe wouldn't have been before. In a way that you don't really see in other sports. You know, if there's a bad baseball team you root for, I don't know, you might be familiar with this. The idea of a team turnaround in baseball could take a decade or more.
Right.
You know, football, it's not an instant thing. It's not just about drafting that one good player. You need to build around him so you have a solid team. And so that can take several years to really pull a team out of it. Whereas basketball, one player really can change a team's fortunes, take a terrible team to at least make the playoffs. And that's really cool. I think from an entertainment perspective, I think the NBA has a good idea of how to do that in attracting new fans.
Yeah, it's really helping me further answer Bob Castellini's fail son, Phil Castellini's question to all the Reds fans of where are you going to go? And to answer that, Phil, I guess the NBA, because if you guys want to keep the Reds sucking, I'm not watching.
That Castellini thing, it's such a baseball owner mentality of like, well,
absolutely.
Well, we're the baseball team. What other baseball team are you going to watch? I might just not watch baseball. Like, that's the thing.
I might just not watch the boring sport and watch the fun sports.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. Also along the sports line, kind of getting into sports cards again, which we kind of grew up in like the worst time possible to collect sports cards in the 90s, like right as that market just absolutely cratered. But it's interesting to see kind of how the steps they've done in the industry to kind of avoid that now and kind of some of the forced scarcity that goes on and exclusivity that goes on. But also at the end of the day, it's kind of just a treasure hunt like any of these other things. And you know, it's just fun to open up a couple packs of cards and see what you get. Like that's the real fun of doing that kind of thing at the end of the day. Like I'm not expecting to pay for a kid's college because of ball cards. Like people in the 90s.
Like a holographic Charizard.
Yeah. It's that same thing, right? Like it's like any, like a lot of the, like loot box type things in video games now, or, buying a lottery ticket, right? Like the real fun is scratching off the lottery ticket, not the idea. Like it's the fantasy of winning the money, right?
Well, and I think baseball cards or any kind of sports cards are so interesting because, especially when you're younger, opening a pack of baseball cards is really a fun experience because like the cards in it, they don't have to have any objective value to you to be cool. If it's your favorite player, it doesn't matter if this isn't an all-star or like a household name. If you get a cool card from your favorite player, it's really cool. So yeah, it's a unique hobby, I think, in terms of collecting.
And as you said earlier, still beats an NFT because at the end of the day, you at least have the card.
Yeah, it exists and it's yours.
What about you, though? What have you been up to?
I was just going to add, I believe I do have a signed Teemu Selanne card floating around here. I believe when he was with the Ducks somewhere. Well, so
we'll talk about that one after the pod.
I'll be accepting offers. I have a Patrick Waugh also when he was with Montreal.
Okay, that one might actually be something.
sitting here somewhere. I think those are probably the only cards I still have in my possession. But yesterday, very exciting, I had the chance to go on the podcast Titanic Talk Line.
Nice.
It's one that I think we've brought up before on the show. I really love the podcast. Alexia does such a great job of finding cool people to talk to, myself included, of course. And just a varied experiences and areas of expertise. You know, she's got authors and other podcasters and other media creators. So yeah, it was really cool to be able to go on there and talk a little bit about Titanic, but a lot about other stuff. We talked a lot about movies and TV shows. And at one point I was singing Toby Keith's Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue.
Okay.
Wasn't part of the plan.
Not what I expected when I heard you were going on that show, but I can't wait to hear it.
We talked about Lusitania a lot because of like all the parallels we were able to draw. Mm-hmm. You know, Titanic sort of setting a precedent for what people thought a shipwreck looked like compared to what happened to Lusitania. But some other wrecks as well. We talked about the Sewell Ferry, La Jolla a little bit, and discussed some possible topics for when we can hopefully get Alexia onto our show.
Nice.
So that was really exciting. Other stuff, Katie and I watched the movie Barbarian, and that was a good movie. I enjoy horror movies. I don't have a hugely deep knowledge of them, but I try to watch the big popular ones when they come out. And that was a cool movie. It was fun to see Justin Long in a more dramatic role, but still having some of his goofiness that, you know, from his earlier roles. I'm also slogging away at a biography of Otto von Bismarck.
Okay.
By Jonathan Steinberg. And I only say slogging because it's kind of dense. You know, it's long, it's detailed. It's very well written. I really like his writing style in presenting the history. It's a lot of mid 19th century German names and titles and government positions and a lot of legal type language, a lot of economic discussions. I'm getting to the point in it where I'm in the 1860s. So getting up to where I'm familiar with Bismarck's body of work a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully I can pick up the pace a little bit, but I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the experience of reading it.
Nice.
So with that, I guess we're ready to talk about our ship.
Let's do it.
Today we're going to talk about a ship called the R.G. Coburn. R.G. Coburn was a wooden-hulled propeller steamer built in 1870 at Marine City, Michigan for E.B. Ward's Lake Superior line.
It's nice being back like on the Great Lakes. It feels comfortable talking about Marine City.
And at some point in this episode, I probably will accidentally call E.B. Ward E.B. White. They're not the same person.
Is that the author of Charlotte's Web?
Yes.
Okay.
Not the pioneer of the Chicago iron and steel industry. The Coburn measured 193 feet in length, 30 feet in beam, and had a depth of 8.5 feet. So she was named for R.G. Coburn, a successful businessman from Superior, Wisconsin.
Really playing all the Great Lakes hits.
And Coburn's success in business can probably be owed to the fact that he just had his finger in so many pies of stuff that people would have wanted. Got an ad here from January 28th of 1871 in the Superior Times, and it reads, R.G. Coburn, wholesale and retail dealer in groceries and provisions, 2nd Street, Superior, Wisconsin. I have now on hand one of the largest stock of groceries and provisions on Lake Superior. To enumerate the articles would be superfluous. My stock is complete in every branch and will be sold at a small margin for cash. My stock of butter is A number 1. I have also a large supply of feed, meal, corn, oats, etc. Call and get prices. I would also say that my planing mill on the Superior City Dock is in good running order and working up daily the large supply of seasoned lumber, which I have just received. Contractors and others will find it to their advantage to give us a call and examine our work. We make door, sash, window frames, and window blinds to order.
This guy is like the Elon Musk of his day, except he actually provides goods and services that are like legit and real.
Yes, I would say, aside from the fact that they're polar opposites in every aspect of their business, yes, he's like Elon Musk.
I also love his ad copy. It's like the best thing ever.
There are approximately 12 different fonts in this, all in different sizes. Like every line is a different one. And I know that's a common thing in ads of this day. And I guess maybe it was just a, you know, standards change over time. And maybe the theory is that every time the font changes, it re-attracts your attention.
Could be.
But it also makes it kind of hard to tell where one ad ends and the next begins. First, I had to kind of parse out, okay, is this the beginning of the next one or is this the end of his ad?
I also like that it said it's sold for a small margin for cash, like just a small margin. I'm not trying to make a lot of money.
I'm not trying to gouge you here. I'm your friend, just trying to get you what you need, get you your corn and your animal feed.
But have you seen my planing mill?
I would say that my planing mill is in good running order. So a bit more about E.B. Ward, the owner of the Coburn. So I don't think Ward has the name recognition of some of his contemporaries, but he was a pretty noteworthy business pioneer of the time. Ward had been successful in Great Lakes shipping. That's how he built his fortune. And in addition to that, he was a major proponent of the construction of the Sioux Locks.
Okay.
Something that's near and dear to upper Midwesterners' hearts.
Yeah.
The Sioux Locks are a hugely integral part of Great Lakes shipping as it exists today, because they allow ships to travel from Lake Superior to the lower lakes. Before that, you had to carry things overland around the Sioux Rapids. Without the Sioux Locks, we don't have the modern Great Lakes shipping industry.
Right.
So his career on the lakes actually started down in the role of cabin boy and then deckhand. It's kind of similar to what we talked about with Alexander McDougall of whaleback fame, you know, starting actually serving on these ships and then moving, you know, in McDougall's case, into a shipbuilding capacity. And in this case, Ward got a job as a clerk and then moved up into more of the, I guess, the front office aspect of things, realizing he had a knack for the business parts. And that's how he ended up making a lot of money off of this.
Like, it is interesting, though, like, at least he had to put in some time kind of at the bottom.
Yeah, and it's
make that more accessible.
It's noted that he got his office role in part thanks to a family connection. I think it was his uncle who got him this position. So I don't know. It may have been the kind of thing where he had this role planned out and they said, hey, you know, if you want this position first, you've got to spend some time on the ships and see how things work.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't really find any more information about that, but he does at least have some experience sailing on the lakes. So after building up that wealth in the shipping industry, Ward looked to iron and steel production as his next endeavor.
Okay.
This is an era of heavy industrialization, you know, the mid-1800s. Of course, at this time, Pittsburgh is the capital of the iron and steel industry in the U.S. And I learned about something interesting. And that is the Pittsburgh Plus system. And I know we talked about this earlier, so I can't in good faith ask you if you've ever heard of it. Pittsburgh Plus system, it was essentially, I think you described it as a cartel.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at it as kind of like an internal tariff. So basically what this was is that, let's say I'm buying steel from a mill in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I buy the product, I pay for the transportation to where I need it, but I also pay what's basically a phantom shipping fee for the distance from Pittsburgh, because I'm not buying a Pittsburgh product. So this is basically a way to ensure that Pittsburgh is seeing money on all steel, regardless of where it comes from. So me as a businessman, if I'm going to have to pay for this transportation from Pittsburgh anyway, I might as well buy it from a Pittsburgh steel mill. And so this,
yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Basically closes the market to other mills.
Yeah, it provides that barrier of entry into the market. Like, no one who wants to get into the iron and steel business if you can't offer a better price, no matter what you do. Like, it's the same as it coming from Pittsburgh. And if you're a buyer, why do you want to pay extra when you can just go to some of the Pittsburgh suppliers and buy it if it doesn't change the price?
Yes. And as you pointed out, something that in the modern world we would see as patently illegal. And
yeah. You can't do this now.
This practice was banned in 1924. Ward was one of the first to realize the utility of producing steel much closer to the origin of the raw material. Most of that iron ore that's going to places like Pittsburgh to produce steel products and iron was coming from the ranges in Minnesota and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Obviously, we've talked about these places a lot because that's all these ships carrying iron ore. That's where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. Producing these products in the same region would naturally lower the cost and time of transportation. We talked about the Pittsburgh Plus system. So my assumption here is that transportation costs must have been lowered significantly enough that it sort of canceled out whatever extra fees people were going to be paying.
Yeah. And I think you probably also potentially have like lower lead times as mm-hmm. far as delivering material if you're closer to where it's going. Because if you think about it, there like isn't really a reason that you should carry this iron ore all the way across all the Great Lakes and mm-hmm. then like, you know, convert it into steel in Pittsburgh and then ship it all the way back to Chicago and Milwaukee and Minneapolis and places like that. Like it is funny to think about.
It reminds me a bit of the mercantile system with Pittsburgh playing the role of like a Great Britain, you know, mm-hmm. say, send us the raw materials, we'll make the stuff and send it back to you.
At a higher price, of course.
Exactly. So by the 1850s, Chicago had a growing iron industry producing small scale home use items like stoves and stuff like that. E.B. Ward, he used his shipping profits to open Chicago's first rail rolling mill in 1857. This is the North Chicago Rolling Mill Company. And so they're producing rails for use in railroads.
Nice.
Something that at this point obviously is blowing up across the country.
And again, you're seeing like as that railroad is pushing west, if you can ship from Chicago to Omaha instead of Pittsburgh to Omaha, mm-hmm. there are some time and cost savings there.
For sure.
Especially if you can find a way around paying that Pittsburgh Plus tariff.
So by 1860, this was one of the biggest businesses in the city with over 200 employees. And by 1870, that number was up to 1,000. In 1865, this mill produced the first rails made of Bessemer steel in the country. So they're also pioneering not just in location, but in what they're producing.
I would also imagine like in this time period with the Civil War going on, it's probably a good time to push back against Pittsburgh a little bit, especially if you're producing for the government, because the government's probably more likely to tell the producers in Pittsburgh to get over it. We need material.
Right. Yin's guys need to give us them rails. Ward opened another mill on the south side of Chicago, and in the 1860s and 70s, other mills opened as well. By the 1880s, Chicago was producing 30% of the United States steel rails.
That's really interesting because I don't feel like Chicago has that perception, mm-hmm. really, of a massive steel producing
right.
you know, place.
So eventually all these mills would merge to form the Illinois Steel Company, which by the end of the century was putting out about 1 million pounds of finished steel product each year. And then, like seemingly every company of the late 19th century, Illinois Steel would later be subsumed into U.S. Steel.
Pittsburgh had its revenge.
And many of those Chicago mills would be closed down to just consolidate things. That production would be moved to the south shore of Lake Michigan, leading to what's possibly the steel industry's greatest sin, the creation of Gary, Indiana. Gary, Indiana was named for the owner of Federal Steel, which was Illinois Steel at the time, Elbert Gary.
I think you could do a fascinating podcast about like the creation and the existence and like kind of the abandonment almost of Gary, Indiana, like mm-hmm. by the steel industry and the lasting effects that it's had there. That'd be an interesting thing to look at.
So basically, we have U.S. Steel to thank for the Jackson 5. Connecting that to more modern times, the Chicago area was one of the places in the U.S. most devastated by the collapse of the U.S. steel industry in the 70s and 80s. You've got like upwards of 15,000 people out of work, steel workers in the Chicago area. And of course, in the United States, you lose your job, you lose your health care.
So, yeah, not great.
It was a very highly impacted area. So, of course, all that's well after E.B. Ward himself is off the scene. He died in 1875. So we'll bring it back to the time of our story here today. So our incident will take place on October 15th, 1871. Now, listeners who are keen of ear and mind and have a good knowledge of Midwest lore might recognize that day as less than a week after another disaster, the Great Chicago Fire, which burned from October 8th to October 10th and killed around 300 people.
Couple things there. I definitely could not have told you that that was in October. That date didn't really like ring out to me. But also, I always forget that only like 300 people died in the Chicago Fire. Like, I feel like that story, you assume there's a lot more. Not that 300 people isn't a lot, but it gets told like it's one of the, you know, great natural disasters in American history. And
to have the name recognition does, it's, I can't think of another fire that people would recognize as much as the Chicago Fire. It's far more noteworthy for what it does to the structure of the city, gutting some of those older, rundown wooden areas and sort of allowing it to become the modern city that Chicago becomes.
Yeah, it's interesting because like the Iroquois Theater fire in 1903 in Chicago kills 602 people.
Really? So, like, that many people died at the Iroquois?
Yeah, so like twice as many people. And like, honestly, like you have to look that up to find out about it, right? Like, that's not something that is common knowledge probably outside of maybe the area of Chicago that it's in.
That's one of the more terrifying disaster stories, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
Like, just the, if fire and like claustrophobia is a fear that you have, the Iroquois Theater fire is just awful, truly. So the Chicago Fire, that's one that people know. October 8th also saw the far deadlier Peshtigo Fire, which killed anywhere from 12 to 2,500 people and burned over 1 million acres.
Yeah, I think that that is one that I didn't know about until living in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And like, that is a truly terrifying event of just how big that fire was, that it became its own weather system and things like that.
Yeah, it's the deadliest wildfire in recorded history, like recorded world history. And I actually just got a book about it called Firestorm at Peshtigo by Denise Guess and William Lutz. So I'm looking forward to that because, yeah, my only real knowledge is just kind of the cultural pickups from living in the area. You hear about it. The museum is not that far away from me and Katie. So, yeah, these two major disasters on the same day, the nation's deadliest fire, along with arguably its most famous, they're sometimes presented as a freak coincidence. Like, how could these two things have happened on the same day? Really just indicative of the dry and windy conditions in the whole region.
Yeah, like, I feel like it makes sense that they happened at the same time, right? Like, if the conditions are set for it.
Yeah, you've got Chicago and Peshtigo, which are very well known. Kind of as a spinoff of the Peshtigo Fire, the whole southern half of the Door Peninsula in Wisconsin is burning. You've also got parts of Michigan's lower peninsula. Holland, Michigan has fires. Even on the other side of Michigan, on the Huron shore of Michigan, you see some. This is a huge regional fire system. And the wind conditions that made the Peshtigo Fire such a nightmare were actually studied in the 1940s by the U.S. military.
Why would they study fire in the 1940s?
To find out, just in case they would ever need to recreate those conditions on a designated target.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they never do anything else with that information. They file it away just as a curiosity. They never deploy it on the city of Dresden.
Or, to be fair, various other Japanese cities as well.
The Peshtigo Fire has fingerprints later throughout history. But for our story, all of that fire creates a lot of smoke, which might play a role here in the story of the R.G. Coburn. So let's talk about the incident.
All right.
October 14th, 1871, The RG Coburn is en route from Duluth to Buffalo, New York.
So she's going like the whole way mm-hmm. across the lake system.
Yep. She carried a cargo of 15,000 bushels of wheat, 3,500 barrels of flour, and 30 barrels of silver ore.
Okay.
Maybe. Probably. Different accounts say different things about her cargo. Some of them describe her as being laden with copper ore.
Silver ore is way more fun.
In some, she's only described as a passenger steamer, which is like the most wrong description here.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of those hybrids, primarily carrying cargo, but also had accommodations for a relatively small number of passengers. We've talked about, I know, a couple of ships like this before, where it's just kind of maximizing what you can get on the ship. Hey, if some passengers need to go the same way, why not accommodate them and, you know, make a little bit of money?
Yeah, there's a lot less rules and regulations at the time, so it is very much like, oh, this will help pay the bills, throw it on there.
On this voyage, she was under the command of Captain Gilbert Dumont. The previous master of the ship had just recently retired, and Dumont had been appointed by the company on a temporary basis to take the Coburn to Buffalo, where she'd be taken over by her new captain, John Condon.
So this guy like knows he's a temporary captain.
Right. He has one job. Literally, you had one job. Now, here to me, this is an odd detail. But this new captain, John Condon, he wasn't in Buffalo.
Okay.
He was on the Coburn.
Okay.
As a passenger.
Interesting.
So I'm assuming there's some sort of business or like paperwork reason that he wasn't just captaining the vessel, but he was basically riding deadhead on this just as a passenger, even though when they got to Buffalo, it was going to be his ship.
I mean, great. Like two captains, double the fun, right?
I don't know why that was the case, but I'm assuming just like a paperwork thing. Maybe he wasn't allowed to take over until they got back to Buffalo or something.
Yeah, maybe there's some, it's probably some weird lame like insurance reason or something.
He needed to watch his training videos.
Yeah, he had to talk to HR and fill out the sexual harassment stuff, you know.
So the Coburn had transited Lake Superior in the Sioux Locks with no issues, making her way down Michigan's eastern shore on Lake Huron. So just after passing Presque Isle, Michigan, the Coburn experienced heavy winds coming out of the northeast. For most of Saturday the 14th, she'd been trailing the steamer Empire, although the Empire stopped at Presque Isle for the night. So here's kind of where the absolutely known facts of the story start to split into differing accounts. Passenger John Gray, who would be a survivor, said that the gale was developing as the Coburn passed Presque Isle, and quote, while other vessels were running for shelter with all speed, Dumont foolishly ordered the Coburn to steam dead ahead into the storm.
I mean, like, I want to know how as a passenger you know that.
And that's one aspect of this, you know, the passenger's assessment of, oh, the gale struck us here probably differs significantly from the crew of a ship who sails on these lakes all the time.
Right.
So, yeah, that allegation was disputed by the ship's second mate, W.L. Haynes, who also survived the ordeal. Haynes will be the highest ranking member of the crew to survive. Haynes disputed the charge of recklessness, saying that the weather was fair when they passed Presque Isle, and that the ship would have had no reason to take shelter. So I'm sure also as a passenger, you know, you see this other ship that you've been following, maybe you see her go into port and you think, oh, well, we probably should do that too, right? And yeah, maybe having less understanding of the situation or what the ship is supposed to be able to handle. So with winds increasing from the northeast by 10 p.m. and the ship starting to roll, Captain Dumont did the smart, safe thing, and he turned the vessel's head into the wind, trying to make for a smoother ride for the passengers, and just safer for the ship overall. So at this point, the ship is basically parked in the middle of the lake, though she's not riding at anchor.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, though, right? Like, you put it out in the middle of the lake, you don't have to worry about grounding it, and you kind of ride it out.
Right. So another contributing factor in the decision to wait it out until morning was the presence of thick, heavy smoke still hanging over the lakes from this enormous system of wildfires. The descriptions of the weather up to this point don't seem too extreme, and if there'd been no passengers aboard, it's possible that Dumont decides to just keep pushing ahead. It seems like this was a decision made for the sake of the passengers.
Mm-hmm.
If it's just a cargo vessel and it's just the crew, maybe they keep going, because he doesn't seem worried about the ship necessarily. Had that been the case, it's possible they could have avoided what comes next. In the early morning of October 15th, the Coburn was struck by a heavy gale out of the southwest coming over the waters of Saginaw Bay. So she's been basically bracing herself against these northeasterly winds, and then everything switches. And suddenly right. She's got this violent gale coming at her from behind. Also, Saginaw Bay, if you're looking at a map of Michigan, the lower peninsula, which is very famously shaped like a mitten, Saginaw Bay is the space between the thumb and the fingers. So while the ship was handling the northeast winds well enough, this sudden storm coming from behind causes major problems for her stability. Concern starts to grow as the ship starts to roll heavily in the water. Passengers and crew were roused and dressed by 3 a.m. Second mate Haynes, he said that the boat held her own until around 4 a.m. By his estimation, they were somewhere off of Thunder Bay, Michigan, when the Coburn lost her rudder. Second mate Haynes described the moment, saying,
"On working the wheel, you revolve so easily that it was at once evident that something was wrong with the steering gear. At first, it was supposed that the chains had parted, but an investigation soon showed that the rudder was gone."
Just imagining that scene, that cannot be a good feeling.
I mean, yeah, like when you turn the wheel and like, oh, it's not connected to anything.
So with her rudder gone, the Coburn had no hope of staying head on to the waves, and she starts to take waves broadside against her hull. One thing you don't want to happen.
Yeah, I think that's what we always kind of talk about in these conditions is like losing your ability to steer or have propulsion is like the worst case scenario because you can't do anything to mitigate the waves.
So at this point, the ship begins to come apart. The smokestack fell, smashing into the cabin area.
That's a bad time.
It's kind of the first dramatic sequence here. On the main deck, cargo begins to come loose, smashing holes in the ship's bulwarks. So with that shifting cargo, it becomes impossible to keep the ship trim, and the Coburn's crew, and some passengers, they resort to tossing cargo overboard to lighten her. Around dawn, a particularly powerful wave hit the ship as she was heeled over at kind of an awkward angle, which smashes open the ship's hold and starts to flood her. Captain DeMont, he sends words to the passengers that they should prepare to abandon ship. But, according to Second Mate Haynes,
"Very few left their cabins. Most were sick, and they did not care to make an effort to save themselves."
Second Mate Haynes managed to launch one of the yawls, taking 7 people with him. 10 others successfully got away from the ship in the other yawl. So these are wooden boats that they're getting in. Haynes was under the impression that these were the only two boats that escaped, but Captain Condon, so this is our deadhead captain, stated that he had seen a third get away. He estimated that there were about 15 people in that third boat, and that a fourth was in the process of launching when the ship went down.
A fourth boat was on the davits, filled with people and being launched, when the Coburn gave a heavy lurch and immediately sank out of sight. The small boat, filled with people, was swamped, and we afterwards saw them in the water.
Most of the descriptions of the sinking itself come from Captain Condon, who, I think it's important to remember, he's watching what was supposed to be his ship going down to the bottom of Lake Huron in pieces.
"When the Coburn went down, her upper cabin was burst off, and we afterwards saw it floating away, covered with people. Before the Coburn went down, I saw Captain DeMont standing on the starboard arch, when a large wave struck him and threw him into the lake. When he rose, he caught a barrel that was floating near him, but he soon sank again and disappeared."
So this testimony from Condon kind of gives us this image of DeMont doing the good captainly thing and going down with the ship.
Mm-hmm.
That gives us positive image, I guess, in that moment of Captain DeMont.
Yeah, I mean, like he did the thing that ship captains are expected to do, right? Especially in this time period.
Captain Condon's boat was picked up around 4 p.m. the same day by the Robert Gaskin. None of the sources said anything about air or water temperature at the time, but if they're in those lifeboats for like 10 to 12 hours, I've got to think that it at least wasn't fatally cold.
Right. I don't think it's the kind of thing you'd want to be out in too long, especially being in the water. Like, you're going to have some issues, but not like the conditions we're talking about when like the SS Milwaukee goes down. Mm-hmm. Like, those guys didn't have a chance.
Also, the Robert Gaskin has an interesting ultimate fate. She would sink in 1889 in the St. Lawrence River. She was assisting in the salvage of the train ferry William Armstrong. So a shipwreck while trying to salvage a shipwreck. It's the recursive shipwreck. So second mate Haynes' boat was picked up by the Zach Chandler near Point of Barks, Michigan, and the survivors were taken to Mackinac, presumably one of the destinations, because it seems like a long way to take survivors if you weren't going there already.
Yeah, that does seem interesting that that's where they went. I also definitely appreciate you putting brackets just in case I had to read that, the Point of Barks thing there, because I would have not nailed that in French.
The biggest travesty there for any French speaker is that barks instead of bark. Two boats washed up at Kincardine, Ontario, along with two bodies, but no survivors. Bodies, debris, and cargo continued to wash up along the Canadian shoreline for some time after. The survivors were a mix of passengers and crew, though, as we've unfortunately seen before, none of the women or children on board the ship survived.
Yeah, that feels pretty familiar, I feel like, at this point in these stories. Do they go into much detail? I mean, I know you said accounts vary. Like, how much of an organized effort was there? Or was it more like, hey, get up and try to get to a boat, and like, that's all we have for you?
Yeah, they had some time with this kind of growing concern. So it seems like there was a fairly good effort from the crew to get people into boats. You've got, you know, 10 people in one, 7 in the other, possibly 15 in a third one. And then there's that fourth one. So it seems like the bulk of the people on board were able to get to or close to lifeboats. Others included among the dead were Captain DeMont, the ship's first mate, William Simmons, first engineer A.S. Robinson, and second engineer Frank Hutchinson, the steward George Westcott, and his wife. This is at a time when it is fairly common to have people traveling with their families. Edward Major, the ship's clerk, Charles Mignot, a porter, passengers Mrs. Thomas Holton and Mary Maughan from Cincinnati, and Helen Palmer of Toledo. So it's not totally clear how many were lost with the Coburn. 12 of the crew and 6 passengers survived. Some sources record a total of 16 passengers and 15 crew being lost with the Coburn, although the total dead is sometimes recorded as 32.
I think that's really interesting that, like, there aren't great records on this because of, like, kind of the transient nature of some of the people that would have been involved.
Yeah, some of the sources, 70 to 75 gets thrown out. I mean, one of my main sources here was James Donahue's Steaming Through Smoke and Fire, and he estimates it at around 70. In the more itemized descriptions of who survives and who is lost, none of it ever seems to add up to 70. So somewhere between 50 and 70 people are probably on board. But again, it's not something that we're able to find out for sure. The Superior Times wrote that
there were 32 passengers in all, 8 of them being ladies. Nearly all of the passengers were confined to their rooms by seasickness, and when rolled up a few minutes before the sinking, they were so sick and exhausted that they expressed a willingness to die in their berths. Mrs. Palmer and Miss Mary Mann never left their rooms, but Mrs. Holton, being locked in her room and unable to find her key, heroically tore the door off the hinges, and after struggling with a sea of water, which then filled the cabin, succeeded in reaching the upper deck and was seen standing within a few feet of the captain when the boat sank out of sight.
That was from one of my sources that was quoting Superior Times. I didn't see the source of that description. I don't know who gave that description.
Yeah, because it's, I mean, not the captain that isn't the captain yet. I don't know.
I'm sorry.
It's weird.
Mrs. Holton being the one who tears the door off and makes it to the deck. I don't know where that came from. Possibly one of the survivors. But it does, at least that story, I think, does at least give some, in kind of the classic tragic heroism of shipwrecks, you do see someone fighting to the very end, mm-hmm. with all their power to survive, when so many of the passengers do just kind of accept the news that the ship's sinking and decide to go down with it.
Yeah, it's almost something that would be cliche in a movie.
Yeah, especially when we see that a good number of the people who make it to the boats do survive. So right. Seeing that effort put forth to get up on deck and try to get to a boat is heartening, I think, in the situation. Getting into some of the aftermath of this, some of the contemporary analysis of the sinking. We don't have an extensive report available for this wreck, but the circumstances of its sinking were analyzed by some of her contemporaries. James Donahue writes in Steaming Through Smoke and Fire that Peter Ralph, 8th District Supervising Inspector of Steamships, suggested negligence on the part of Captain Dumont.
If the anchors had been let go so as to have brought the vessel's head into the wind, as the depth of the water and the locality of the disaster is only from 30 to 40 fathoms, and the vessel having good anchors with 90 fathoms of chain each, there is a probability this loss of life and property might have been lessened, if not entirely avoided.
So the point being made by Ralph here is that even without the rudder, there would have been avenues available for Captain Dumont to keep the head into the wind, mm-hmm. By dropping anchor, twisting the ship around so that she's still fixed in this position.
Right.
And the idea that maybe Captain Dumont wasn't prepared for a situation like this. He wasn't aware that these were his options. So Ralph continued to say that given the sufficient lifeboats on the Coburn, everyone could have escaped with a properly managed evacuation.
Two metallic lifeboats were picked up on the Canada shore, right side up, which evidently were not used, except by two of the crew, Porter and Barber, who were found dead on the beach near where the boats came ashore. The 18 survivors had wooden boats.
And with that quote, I'm not sure if Barber and Porter are the names, or I think he's referring to their positions on the boat.
Yeah, I guess that could go either way.
They're capitalized in the text. And I think it's interesting that Ralph, he seems to say that more could have survived if they'd gotten to lifeboats, while in the same breath pointing out that the ones who apparently got to these didn't survive.
Mm-hmm.
I think also looking at the evidence here, you've got two bodies, two lifeboats that have washed ashore. The bodies were not found in the lifeboats, either of them. So it's kind of a big assumption to make that they ever were. I mean, these things are washing up together.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily imply that they were ever in the boat.
That's a one-to-one person-to-boat ratio. You'd think if they escaped together, they'd probably be in the same lifeboat.
Yeah.
So this easily could just have washed up together coincidentally.
And like, I guess I see his point, though, of like, the more people you get in the boats, the more people that have a chance to survive. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you don't know that either. You don't know that like they would have survived if they had made it to the boats.
Because, yeah, from all we can see in the survivor testimony, a lot of people did make it to the boats.
Mm-hmm.
That ultimately wasn't successful for a good portion of them. So that's basically the wrap up to the wreck itself. We've got, it's again hard to say exactly how many people were lost, but we do have a good portion of survivors who are able to tell the story. And I want to bring it back to Coburn himself, the man that this was named for, because this was somewhat seen as a kind of indicative of the man's fortunes overall around this time. The fact that this ship named for him went down. So the July 28th, 1877 issue of the Superior Times published a short piece on Coburn announcing his departure from the city. And I'll say this, I don't know if we have a word for this, but it's like an obituary, but instead of announcing his death, it's announcing that he's moving. So that reads,
Mr. and Mrs. R.J. Coburn, their two daughters, son Percy, and Miss Gracie Snow, left on the St. Paul Thursday for their old home in Forestville, Chautauqua County, New York, where they will hereafter reside. It is sad to see Mr. Coburn and family leave Superior, yet all his friends cannot but feel and hope that the move will be a good one for him. The friends of his youth will welcome Mr. Coburn to their midst after his absence of 25 years, 22 of which were spent in this place, during which he rose to be one of the leading merchants and businessmen on Lake Superior, owning vessels, dealing in lumber and merchandise, filling government contracts on public works, in fact, taking a hand in every measure where pluck and enterprise were demanded.
The late E.V. Ward so highly esteemed the character of Mr. Coburn that he honored him by naming one of his best steamboats the R.G. Coburn, whose ill fate on Lake Huron some years ago is still fresh in memory. For the last 6 or 7 years, Mr. Coburn has been the victim of a series of unfortunate circumstances. Losses by fire, failures, depression of real estate, and ill luck generally, reducing his available resources to almost nothing, and he leaves us a comparatively poor man. We trust he will do well in his new home, into which the very best wishes of this entire community accompany him and his family.
That is really interesting. That does read, all of it reads like an obituary. Like, there's like a tragic element to it, a sadness.
It kind of shows the presence that he would have had in the city. You know, the fact that this guy isn't here anymore, that's something worthy of discussion and publication of the newspaper. And yeah, it definitely has a somber ending saying, well, we hope things start looking up for him, maybe in his new home.
And I think it shows you like how much more plugged into the community these people are than like business leaders today, mm-hmm. especially like big business leaders. But these guys are actually a part of the community and interacting with the community, providing services, right, and doing things. And it is interesting to see like people genuinely be sad that they're leaving.
Yeah. I mean, I guess a recent example you could draw is in the recent governor's race in Wisconsin. You had Tony Evers defending his governorship against Tim Michaels, who in this area, you see Tim Michaels construction stuff all over the place. Across from my work the past few months, there's been a Tim Michaels construction crew. So big name. But, you know, when he lost the governor's race, they had to do his interview on video from his house in Vermont, because that's where he lives. So, yeah, this idea that, you know, business owners actually living in and being part of and contributing to the community that they exist in, to the extent that when they leave, you need to, it's basically like they died.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting. It's a very interesting idea that, I don't know, probably leads to some better results in some ways.
So the Coburn remains elusive to shipwreck hunters, although it does show up on a lot of, you know, diver wish lists of, you know, things that are being really highly sought after. That's where a lot of the online information about it comes from, is, you know, diving or, you know, underwater exploration websites. NOAA had a page about it, talking about wrecks that are as yet undiscovered, but being actively sought for. You know, we have a rough idea of where it went down. It's very, very rough. That's kind of one to keep an eye on. And, you know, someday maybe we see a headline, R.G. Coburn discovered in Lake Huron.
Yeah, that's like one of my favorite things, is every time one of these ships is discovered, we get tagged in posts on Twitter and stuff like that. And like, it's so fun seeing, you know, because sometimes we miss it. You know what I mean? We don't always see it. And it's just fun seeing other people get excited about it.
So that was an interesting one to research. I had to, kind of gave me a chance to do some research on some of the business practices of the day, learn about some tangentially related people. But ultimately, it was just another good story, another good Great Lakes wreck story.
Cool. Yeah, I'm always interested in these kind of stories, like the classic Great Lakes shipwreck stories. And I think it helps you understand maybe the impact of like an Edmund Fitzgerald or something like that, when you kind of understand the history and where this comes from. Because, you know, these were the stories those guys were telling each other. Like, you know, that they sat around and talked about these, you know, the disappearance of this ship or what happened. So it always is interesting to get into the head of the people that continue to do this, even being aware of stories like this. Mm-hmm. I think it's another interesting case.
Cool. We will wrap it for this week, and we will be back to talk to you next week with some more maritime mishaps.